Exodus, some final comments. The 36th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on March 25, 2018 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 34, Exodus, some final comments, accompanies this talk.
We're going to finish Exodus today. We have worked our way through the entire text, and now I just want to make some concluding comments. About 2 months ago, I decided that I needed to make some concluding comments at the end, and since then I've been trying to figure out exactly which comments I wanted to make, and I have narrowed it down, and so I'm going to talk about three things. One is I want to talk about one example of how Exodus is used in the rest of the Old Testament. The second thing I'm going to talk about is some of the main themes in Exodus. And then thirdly, I want to talk about the Jewish feasts for one last time. But yesterday I got an email from Roger, who's been listening to the series, and he asked two questions. So I'll read those first. Question one, are the Jews obligated to keep Moses today? And this is something that I am kind of working through in my own mind. My understanding at this point is that no, the Jews are not obligated to keep the law. I assume that's what he's talking about. They are not obligated to keep the law. However, there's another question, and that is it wise? And that becomes a really tricky question. My wife and I have made several trips to Israel, and we have visited the church. It's a messianic community that meets at this church where my daughter goes. And every time we've been there, in one way or another, the issue of whether and how they should keep the law comes up. It's a big topic for them, for Messianic Jews in Israel. And there are lots of nuances to it. It's not just a simple yes or no question. You have to parse out, well, what do we mean by that, and which laws, and how, and et cetera, et cetera. But I would say that the dominant answer that they are giving is that, yes, they should. And it's not because God requires it of them, but it's out of solidarity with their fellow countrymen. They want to show that they are genuinely descendants of Abraham, and that's the way they have chosen to do that. So it's an interesting issue, and there are lots of little facets to it. The second question. What role does morality play in a nation God has set free? Specifically, it seems to me that if God were to truly make America great again, he would open our eyes and give our people a hunger for the truth. To that end, if I understand American history correctly, American education set about to educate freemen to live freely among other freemen. Does the story of Exodus teach us something about ourselves? I'm going to save the answer of that until the middle of my talk because it comes into what I was going to talk about. Okay, the first issue. the importance of the Exodus for the rest of the Bible. The Exodus is referred to, is alluded to many times in the Old Testament as well as many times in the New Testament. It just keeps popping up. It's one of the seminal works, it seems to me, of the Bible. It shows up in particular in the Psalms, allusions in the Psalms, as well as the prophets in the Old Testament. And then it shows up in a couple of the Gospels and then the writings of Paul. So there are a lot of allusions to Exodus and the rest of the Bible. One of the things I thought about talking about is tracing through how and why Exodus is alluded to in the rest of the Bible. But I quickly decided that was too big of a project to take on at this point in time. It's one that I would like to take on, but it's too big right now. So there is another topic that I also thought about addressing that is also big, and that is the issue of idolatry. Idolatry is a big issue in Exodus. There are several sections where the Israelites are told, warned against idolatry. There are about four sections where that's the specific topic, warning them against idolatry. The first of the Ten Commandments is against idolatry. And, of course, the greatest crisis in Exodus is when they make a golden calf and worship it. So idolatry is a very big issue in Exodus. And I thought about talking about idolatry in general and decided that that, too, is too big of a topic. But I got a book and started reading it on idolatry. It's by Halbertal, just entitled Idolatry. And I found the first section of it particularly interesting. And what I found is, in his discussion of idolatry, as it's talked about in the Bible, Exodus keeps coming up. So I'm just going to use this as one example of how the book of Exodus is alluded to elsewhere in the Old Testament. Halbertal argues that adultery becomes the root metaphor for understanding idolatry. It's the metaphor, the main metaphor for understanding idolatry. And he goes on to argue that metaphor is a major means of communication in the Bible. He says it's everywhere in the Bible. You find it constantly. He's a Jewish author writing about the Old Testament, where that's certainly true, but that carries over into the New Testament as well. My wife and I have been going through the Gospel of John. And in the Gospel of John, Jesus very frequently uses metaphors, and the metaphors are misunderstood. That's a common dynamic that you see in the Gospel of John. And then, at the end of his life, he speaks plainly, and his disciples comment, "You're speaking plainly." So it must have been a main way of him for him to communicate. How does a metaphor work? There are lots of books at the University of Oregon Library on metaphors. That's a hot topic. It has been for the last couple decades. So there are lots and lots of books. And I was skimming some of them. And one of them was very interesting. He made the argument that we all know how metaphors work because we use them all the time. It's just a part of our speech. People use metaphors. However, when we're using them in circumstances that we're very familiar with, we can identify a metaphor and we know what to do with it, how to interpret it. It's when a metaphor is used in contexts and in circumstances that aren't quite as familiar that we run into trouble. And that's why he argues that we need to think carefully about how metaphors work. A metaphor is simply a way of saying, of explaining something by saying that X is like Y. So we have two things, X and Y, and there is some way or some ways in which X is like Y. And typically that's done where one of those concepts is much more familiar to us than the other one. So if I say white like snow, well, there are lots of different whites, but snow is a very known concept, and I can say, I know what snow, the color of snow, okay, well, white like snow is that color. Adultery, then, can be used as a metaphor for idolatry because we understand adultery. It is a part of human relations. We have some familiarity with it. It's in the community one way or another. And so we can use that more familiar concept to understand the less familiar, which is idolatry. With a metaphor, you never know how extensive the overlap is or the correlation is. And in interpreting that, that always has to be sorted out. But between adultery and idolatry, the primary overlap is that both of them are exclusive relationships. That's the key concept from adultery that carries over, and is also true of idolatry. It's a violation of an exclusive relationship. In Exodus, there are already hints that adultery is a good comparison, a good way of understanding the wrong associated with idolatry. And as we went through the text, I pointed out that at the incident of the golden calf, it says that the people of Israel, they went to play. And that word to play has the connotation of playing around. That is, it has an adulterous connotation. Secondly, afterwards, the people were forced to drink a combination of water and gold from the idol, from the golden calf, which corresponds to a prescribed way of dealing with adultery later on in the law, where dirt is supposed to be taken from the floor of the tabernacle and mixed with water and given to the one who's been accused of adultery. And I think if it makes them sick, then they were guilty. I'm not sure how the test works exactly. Also, in that same incident, God had 3,000 people killed for worshiping the idol, and death was the penalty for adultery. After the incident, when God decides to spare the people, he tells them, don't wear any jewelry, no more jewelry. And that is apparently an indication that the jewelry was as jewelry from a wedding, from a marriage, wedding rings. And they were to be taken off and no longer to wear jewelry. So that too kind of likens it to a breach of a marriage kind of relationship. And I'll point out that later Jewish tradition likened the making of the covenant with God to be a marriage between the people of Israel and God. And then finally, it says that God is a jealous God. He's a jealous God in the sense that a husband is jealous with respect to his wife. So those are all indications that even in Exodus, adultery is being used as a metaphor for idolatry. As we progress into the Old Testament, that metaphor comes up several times in which it likens Israel to the adulterous woman and God to the husband. In Hosea, God has Hosea carry out what I call prophetic theater. I don't know if anyone else uses that term, but there are a number of times where prophets are told to act something out. And the act, that this acting out that they perform has some kind of symbolic value. Well, Hosea was told to act, was told to do something, which turns out to be prophetic theater. He was told to take a prostitute as a wife. He was told that that wife, that prostitute wife, would run after other lovers. But when those other lovers didn't take care of her, she would come back to Hosea, and that he was to punish her by cutting her off from his wealth. Halbertal says, the main function of the husband in Hosea's metaphor is the satisfaction of the wife's material needs. Extending the metaphor, it is God who satisfies Israel's needs by giving grain, wine, and oil. When God sees that he has been betrayed, he swears to kill his wife by thirst and to have no mercy on her children. The betrayal is analyzed as an extension of the same motif, that Israel prefers her lovers because she thinks they satisfy her needs more successfully, because she thought, I will go after my lovers who supply my bread and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. So Israel leaves God and goes in search of other gods whenever she feels like she is not being cared for the way that she would like to be cared for. Halbertal goes on to say, the sin of idolatry is whoredom. Israel gives her favors to whoever pays her the highest fee. But idolatry is worse than ordinary prostitution, because in this case, the fee is always being paid with the husband's faithfulness and love for his wife, and the wife's faithless behavior. For the wife, sexual relations are based on pay, and she believes that the lover pays more. In theological terms, the Israelites relate to God as to a supplier of material goods, and when he seems to have disappointed them, they turn to other gods. But in Hosea, in the end, God regains the love of Israel by wooing Israel like he did in the beginning. Another quote from Halbertal. Hosea also alludes to the date of the couple's marriage in his description of the end of the crisis. And then quoting from Hosea, assuredly, I will speak coaxingly to her and lead her through the wilderness and speak to her tenderly. I will give her vineyards from there and the valley of Achor as a plowland of hope. There she shall respond in the days of her youth when she came up from the land of Egypt. The reconciled couple return to the place where they first met and renew the days of their youth. A clear romantic flavor has been added to the metaphor, as God is not only a supplier of material goods, but also a lover. Moreover, this passage shows us that the couple met in the desert at the time that the Israelites left Egypt. So in using adultery as a metaphor for idolatry, Hosea comes back round to pointing out that there was a honeymoon time in the relationship between Israel and God, and that was when they left Egypt. Jeremiah sees that time period similarly. I quoted this a couple weeks ago, I think. I accounted to your favor the devotion of your youth. Your love as a bride how you followed me in the wilderness. So once again, a reference to the Exodus. But then Jeremiah goes on to describe how Israel later strayed away looking for other lovers. The prophet Ezekiel then takes this analogy in just a little different direction. He too likens idolatry to adultery, but he likens Israel not to a prostitute, but to a nymphomaniac. So Israel, instead of going to the highest bidder, she pays her lovers to come to her. And Ezekiel then goes on to explore how is reconciliation possible in this case. The wrongdoing is just too great for reconciliation to happen. And this would make forgiveness impossible, or at least unspeakably gracious. But that's what God does. God does forgive. And this results in eternal gratitude from the wayward wife. So that's the way this analogy is used in Ezekiel. But Ezekiel says specifically in Ezekiel 16, verse 60, "Nevertheless, I will remember the covenant I made with you in the days of your youth and will establish it with you as an everlasting covenant." Again, likening the relationship, the making of the covenant to a marriage. So in each of these cases, it is understood that an exclusive marriage-like relationship was consummated in the wilderness between Israel and God. And the covenant that was sealed on Mount Sinai was that moment when that happened. And the last six chapters of Exodus, then, are the honeymoon period of that relationship. Okay. So that's just one little thread that I traced. But the Exodus is relevant background for many, many other passages in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. Okay, the main themes of Exodus. First of all, the actors in the book of Exodus and what we learn about them. The first actor is the people of Israel. And what we see about the people of Israel in the book of Exodus is that they are a rebellious lot. They reject leadership of Moses. Moses has been sent to lead them out of Egypt, and they are very, very reluctant to accept his authority. Furthermore, all the way along the line, they complain. They complain about a lack of this, a lack of that, a discomfort here, a discomfort there, and they want to go back to Egypt. They are also obstinate. That's a word that God uses in describing them. They repeat their rebellion despite God's acts of care and provision. It doesn't matter how many times God comes through and provides for the things that they have complained about lacking. It doesn't keep them from complaining again. They are also impatient. In the incident of the golden calf, what they wanted was God to be with them. And they couldn't stand to wait any longer until that need was satisfied. Even though God had already given the plans to Moses for the tabernacle to be built, a place for God to come and be in their midst, had they just waited a little longer, that need was going to be taken care of in the way that God wanted to take care of it. So those are the people of Israel. People, by the way, that I think we can all identify with if we've reflected on ourselves at all. God, God is one who is loyal to his promises. He made a promise to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then, after hundreds of years, 400 years, God begins to act to fulfill the promises that he had made. He's determined to fulfill his promises, to be good on them. He's also a powerful God. And we see that particularly in the 10 plagues that he inflicts on Egypt in order to force the Pharaoh to let them go, the Israelites go. And the plagues demonstrate that God is more powerful than any Egyptian god. He is more powerful than the forces of nature. And he is more powerful than any human power. His power also shows up in his miraculous provision for the Israelites in the wilderness. The miraculous provision of water, the miraculous provision of manna, and the miraculous provision of quail. And in each of those cases, God is able to use, and here I think he's using the laws of nature to bring about the results that he wants to bring about. God is also a God of admirable moral character. And this seems to be the thing of which he is most proud. This is the thing when he shows himself to Moses, he says, I am a God of this kind. And here's what he says. He is compassionate. He is gracious. He is slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness and truth, and forgiving but just. Those seem to be the qualities that he is most proud of. Furthermore, with respect to God, we see that he can be related to as a person. He is not just a force like gravity, an impersonal force. He is a person. And we see that because God decides he's going to wipe out the Israelites in the incident of the golden calf. And Moses goes back to him three times and asks for God to relent. And he gets three different concessions from God. So Moses is able to relate to him as a person, appeal to him as a person, and change God's mind. And lastly, God knows what he's doing, and he's able to do it. The stuff is all planned out. The promises that he makes 400 years in advance, he knows how he's going to fulfill them, and at the right time, he puts that into motion and does it. The third character that I want to talk about is Moses. Moses, first of all, is a humble man. He was humbled by his experiences before leading the people out of Egypt. As you will recall, they rejected his leadership. And when God came to him and wanted to and asked him to go lead the people out of Egypt, he didn't want to do it. And I think he was so burned and so humiliated by what had happened that he didn't want to do it. Numbers 12:3 says that he was the most humble of men. There's a comment there. And I think we see that already in the book of Exodus. Moses' intercession for the people was a high point in the book. That Moses was willing to intercede for his people and even, even give his eternal life, lay down his eternal life for his people. He too is of high moral character, and in fact, his moral character reflects that of God himself. He's loyal, he's loving, and he's extremely forgiving. And then we see growth in Moses. Early on, we see one who is defeated, rejected, and burned by this ungrateful people. Later on, he is willing to give his eternal life for this same ungrateful people. As I've said before, I think Moses is an extremely impressive character as he emerges in the book of Exodus. Okay, so those are the actors that we see in Exodus and the kinds of qualities that come out. Now, what are the themes? And I think there are two main themes. One is nation building, and the second is redemption. If you think about it, what is the difference? When do you have a nation? What God said he was going to do in the covenant is he was going to make them a nation of priests and a holy kingdom? Or is it the other way around? I can't remember. But anyway, he was going to make a nation out of them. And what is a nation? If you think about it, we have different words for different kinds of groups of people. The most basic would be a crowd. A crowd is a group of people. But it is a group of people that they have no common purpose necessarily, they have no interconnection, it's just a bunch of people. We could develop that further. We could use another word, mob. A mob is a group of people, but it has a common intent, at least a common short-term intent. And usually, the way we use the word mob, it would be a malintent. It's a bad intent. But at least there's something that holds them together. They aren't just a crowd. And then we could go on. There are other groups of people, words that we could use to describe groups of people. But eventually you get to a nation. What is a nation? And a nation is an interconnected people with a common purpose. They have a common purpose that they're all working towards, and they are all, to one degree or another, interconnected. Historically, a nation often shared familial ties. That's one of the things that connected them, was they all shared a common ancestor. But not every nation has shared familial ties, and America is a good example of that. America is not a nation that is based on shared bloodlines. And not every group with shared familial ties is a nation. A nation has to be people interconnected with a common purpose. When the Israelites left Egypt, they were not a nation. They were a group of people. They had shared familial ties, but they weren't highly interconnected, and they lacked a shared purpose. And in Exodus 12:38, it says, when the Israelites left, a mixed multitude also went with them. So there were people within that group that was moving through the wilderness besides just the descendants of Abraham. So what we see in Exodus is taking this crowd of people, and they slowly become what we would call a nation. And how does that happen? They gain a shared history, shared traditions, shared values, and close personal ties. How does that happen in Exodus? First of all, the shared history. God brings all of them out of Egypt and through difficult circumstances together. Those are circumstances that actually create bonds. I used to do quite a bit of when I was much younger, I did quite a bit of backpacking. And I was talking to one of my friends who I went backpacking with frequently. We were just kind of reflecting on some of our trips. And the strange thing was that the most memorable parts of our backpacking trips were always shared misery. There's something about that shared misery that is, it may be unpleasant, but it's also bonding. It does create a closeness that other things would not do. So you can think of their trip through the wilderness as a backpacking trip. Shared traditions. God establishes for them festivals and religious practices that are shared throughout the community. There are shared values. God gave them the law, and those become the values on which the society is based. And they develop close personal ties. And I think that's the building of the tabernacle is particularly interesting from that perspective. The building of the tabernacle was this big project that required the efforts of everybody in the community in one way or another. And they came at this with a lot of enthusiasm and were very willing to participate. And that kind of project is very unifying. It's something that creates personal bonds like nothing else. When there is a single task that you're working with someone else over a long period of time, day by day, that creates connections that could not otherwise be created. So for God to give them that task to build the tabernacle, I think is very interesting, and I think it's very much part of the nation building that God wanted to bring about in the Exodus. The other main theme is redemption. Exodus becomes the ultimate story of redemption. God made promises to the patriarchs. Then to make good on those promises, God began to act. And interestingly, he began to act before the people cried out to him for God to save them. I think that's interesting. Another situation where God is doing the things that need to be done for us before we realize that those things need to be done. God raised up a man, Moses, to provide leadership to bring them out of Egypt. Then he hammered Egypt with the 10 plagues, the last plague being the killing of all the firstborn of Egypt. However, the firstborn of Israel were spared by virtue of the blood of the sacrificed lambs. He miraculously then freed them from their slavery in Egypt. Then, having freed them, and having led them through the wilderness, he offers to make a covenant with Israel in which Israel agrees to be obedient to God and God agrees to make Israel into a holy nation. That agreement is formally signed, that is to say, they agree to it in a formal ceremony. But In 40 days after that agreement is signed, the people of Israel immediately violate the agreement because they worshiped an idol, because they are impatient to have God with them. So the covenant was nullified, and God wanted to destroy Israel and start over with Moses, but Moses persuaded him to relent. And Moses continued to talk to God and convinced God to reconcile fully with the people of Israel. Then the people built the tabernacle that God had described, and God dwelt in the midst of the people. And that's the completion of the redemption that God brought about. It's a wonderful story and a great paradigm for what redemption's all about. Okay, the Jewish feasts. I've talked about this before, and I won't spend too much time on it, but the Jewish feasts are a big deal in the Exodus. There are two times that God tells the people that it's very important for them to keep the feasts. The first time was just before the incident with the golden calf. The second time was just after the incident with the golden calf. What is very curious is the purpose of those feasts is never really spelled out. It is never really explained why those feasts should be celebrated and even how they should be celebrated, with the exception of Passover. But for the others, we don't have that kind of explanation, and I think that's very curious. The feasts are named, and instructions are given as to when they are to be celebrated. Very little is said with respect to how they're to be celebrated and what is the significance of it. So they kind of present a puzzle to be solved. There were, over time, within the Jewish culture, traditions developed around each feast. And interestingly, those traditions arose in the context of a people immersed in the biblical text. But it is also a people that views the traditional teachings of the rabbis as more or less authoritative. And as a result, there are a wide variety of traditions with respect to each of the feasts. And as a result, how the way that the feasts are actually celebrated, there isn't, it seems to me, there is not a great deal of coherence between them. But I think that a coherence was intended. It seems to me that a careful reading of the text reveals that the feasts are all based on events in Exodus. I've mentioned before, this is a minority view, but I have found people that agree with me. I found a section from a book called The Jewish Way by Rabbi Irving Greenberg in the U of O library. And this either proves that there is substance to what I'm saying, or you can find anything if you look long enough. Here's what he says. The Exodus is the core event of Jewish history and religion. The central moment of Jewish religious history is Yetziat Mitzrayim, Exodus from Egypt. In this event, a group of Hebrew slaves were liberated. The initiative for freedom had to come from God, for the slaves were so subjugated that they accepted even the fate of genocide. Moses, called by God, came to Pharaoh with a request that the slaves be given a temporary release to go and worship in the desert. Then, step by step, the power of Pharaoh was broken. Step by step, the temporary release escalated into a demand for freedom. Thus, the Torah makes its point that the entry of God into history is also a revelation of human dignity and right to freedom, and foreshadows the end of absolute human power with all its abuses. The Exodus inaugurated the biblical era of the Jewish people's history. In Judaism's teaching, the Exodus is not a one-time event, but a norm by which all of life should be judged and guided. The Exodus is an orienting event, an event that sets in motion and guides the Jewish way, and ultimately humanity's way, toward the promised land, an earth set free and perfected. And as they walk through local cultures and historical epochs, People can gauge whether they have lost the way to freedom by charting their behavior along the path against the Exodus norms. An analogy: a rocket fired into space navigates by a star such as Canopus. It even makes a mid-course correction by measuring its relationship to the celestial marker. So does the Exodus serve as the orienting point for the human voyage through time and for mid-course corrections on the trajectory toward final redemption. Exodus is brought into life and incorporated into personal and national values through the classic Jewish behavior model, reenactment of the event. The basic rhythm of the year is set through the reenactment of the Exodus, Passover, followed by the covenant acceptance, Shavuot or Pentecost, and then a restaging of the Exodus way, Sukkot or Feast of the Tabernacles. For the Israelite living in biblical times, the holidays were concentrated in 2 months, the first month, Aviv, in later times renamed Nisan, which incorporated the 7 days of Passover, and the seventh month, Yetanim, in later times renamed Tishrei, with 1 day of Rosh Hashanah, 1 day of Yom Kippur, 7 days of Sukkot, and an eighth day of closure. Both months were dominated by the Exodus holidays. The only other annual holiday was Shavuot, which occurred on 1 day in the third month. Okay. He puts his own, I would say, modern Jewish spin on it, but he is tying the holidays to the book of Exodus and seeing the holidays as a reenactment then of Exodus. The thing that I would do differently is it seems to me, he is saying that the three holiday periods map onto Exodus, but there are actually seven feasts within those three time periods, and it seems to me that each individual feast maps onto an event in Exodus. Now, I'm not sure exactly how they map on to the events in Exodus. But so here is just my guess at this point in time. It starts with the spring feasts. The religious calendar of Israel starts in the spring. It starts with Passover. And what does that feast represent? It represents the first Passover, when the angel of death came and killed the firstborn of Egypt. The second of the spring feasts is first fruits. At first fruits, the people of Israel were supposed to present the first of the harvest from the barley, if I'm not mistaken. That is offered to God. And until that is given to God, then they can't eat any of the harvest. What does that map onto? Well, it seems to correspond to the day with the crossing of the Red Sea. The third feast, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, there's very little information about what this is and how it's to be celebrated, except that they are supposed to eat unleavened bread for 7 days because they had to hurry to leave Egypt. So this is the one that's most difficult for me to map on to an event in Exodus, but apparently it's the flight into the wilderness. That's the first of two holidays that are seven-day feasts. And I take that to mean that they stand for something that is not a point-in-time event in Exodus. All of the others stand for point-in-time events in Exodus, but not these two seven-day feasts. The fourth feast, Pentecost or Shavuot, that one, very little is said about how that's to be celebrated. It is a celebration of the harvest of the wheat, historically. But it corresponds, the date that they are supposed to celebrate that corresponds to the day when the people of Israel made the covenant with God and were given the law. And in fact, in some of the Jewish traditions then, on that feast, they read through the law. Okay, the fifth feast is Rosh Hashanah, or the Feast of Trumpets. And I talked about this as we were going through the text, but I think that corresponds to when Moses came down from Mount Sinai after he had been given the instructions on how to build the tabernacle, and after he had learned that the people of Israel had made an idol. There's virtually nothing said about how the Feast of Trumpets is supposed to be celebrated. It just says that it's to be celebrated as a memorial. It doesn't say what it's supposed to be a memorial of. But I think it has to be when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai. I should point out that the chronology gets difficult for the last three feasts in Exodus. The first four feasts, all except for the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the other three, they map onto events in Egypt to the day. The Feast of Trumpets, you can only approximate it because there isn't enough chronological data in Exodus to figure it out for sure. But it is approximately when Moses came down from Mount Sinai. The sixth one, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, I think that corresponds to the event when Moses asked God to forgive the Israelites. He says he's going to go in before God and see and ask for atonement. He uses that word. Then the last, and another seven-day feast, the Feast of Tabernacles, when the Israelites are supposed to build these huts, and they're supposed to eat their meals in those huts, and throughout that seven-day period of time. And the huts are supposed to have a roof made out of, I think it's palm leaves, and it's supposed to have some fruits incorporated into the hut. And that feast, I think, corresponds to the journey with God through the wilderness. So that's after the building, sometime during the construction of the tabernacle, and then on the rest of the way through the wilderness. Okay, that's my best guess. If that's true, then the celebration of the feasts constitutes a reiteration of the main events of the of Exodus, and gives a continuity to those feasts that would otherwise not be there. And it is quite amazing, I think, an amazing story. There is also very good reason to think that the feasts map onto events in the history of salvation as well. So those feasts represent key events in the Exodus, which is our salvation from this world of sin, from what John calls the cosmos. And here's how those would map on. And this one, in talking about this, you can find lots of websites that talk about this. This is commonly held. There are some disagreements as to exactly what the last three feasts represent, but otherwise, there's a lot of agreement. So the Passover, what does it represent in the salvific history? The crucifixion. Jesus was crucified on Passover, and in fact, I think it's either Luke or Matthew tells us the time. It's at 3:00 in the afternoon, which is the time that lambs were sacrificed in the temple for Passover. First fruits, That corresponds to the day that Jesus rose from the dead, the resurrection. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, and again, this is a little problematic here to know exactly what that corresponds with, but it seems to be representing the period before Jesus' ascension, after the resurrection and before the ascension. The fourth one, Pentecost, that corresponds to the coming of the Holy Spirit. That happened on Pentecost, on Shavuot. Then, the fall feasts, it is commonly understood that those have not happened yet in salvific history. The Feast of Trumpets is, and my best guess, and there are disagreements about this, but my best guess is Jesus' second coming is the Feast of Trumpets. The Day of Atonement is Judgment Day. And the Feast of Tabernacles is the Eternal Kingdom. So if that's true, then the feasts also tell the story of salvific history, the work of Christ and what that has brought about, the redemption that that has brought about. And it seems to me, in any case, that Moses is a remarkable picture of Jesus and the work that Jesus did in going before God and asking for atonement for us. It's a beautiful picture. Okay. I'll stop for any questions and comments, and then I'll just make a couple concluding statements.
Thanks, David.
Uh-huh.
A couple of things. When you were talking about the mapping of the feasts onto the events in Exodus, on at least some of them, you said this is our best guess. And I'm just curious whose best guess and what do the Israelites, what are the Jews, how do they map these and on what basis do they map them? That's one question.
Well, they don't. Except for, I found two books where they don't map the individual feasts onto events in Exodus, but they map the spring feasts onto Passover and surrounding events, Pentecost onto the giving of the law and the making of the covenant, and the fall feasts onto essentially eternity.
So when Jews celebrate these feasts, they have this common understanding that this feast is celebrating that event.
No.
No. Okay.
They don't. For most Jews, no. They would not see it that way. And I don't know well enough to be able to really represent them, but if you look at the books that describe each feast, it is an assortment of practices, traditions that have developed. But most of the books that describe the Jewish feasts don't even attempt to tell you what the purpose of the feast is, to try to narrow it down to what is the purpose of this feast.
Great, thank you. And then secondly,
which I think, if I'm right, it seems to me that this would be particularly interesting for a Jew to see the feasts that they've been celebrating for eons, and which feasts, the traditions of which have evolved, and some of those have evolved and developed practices that reflect what actually happened in Exodus, which I think is quite amazing, for them to see that there's that connection between what they've been celebrating all this time and what's going on in Exodus, I think that would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, thank you. And then secondly, the mapping of the feasts onto the events in salvific history, mm-hmm. some of those, like Pentecost seems clearly related to the coming of the Holy Spirit. That's when it happened. On what basis are the other mappings done, and with what confidence are they made?
It's a little bit, my thinking is, we know that three of the first four happen on feast days. It's an event, a significant event in salvific history that happens on a feast day that celebrates the same thing that's happening in salvific history, the Passover. Jesus was crucified. There's got to be a correspondence there. First fruits, they pass through the Red Sea. Those are the first ones delivered, the first ones redeemed. Well, that's also the resurrection. There's got to be a significance there. Now, unleavened bread, it's harder. I admit that's a harder one because I think it's not a point-in-time event. But then Pentecost, the coming of the Holy Spirit, it's got to be. So then the others is just projecting. If those are all like that, doesn't it make sense that the last three would also be representative of key events in salvific history that have not yet happened? But the events, if I'm understanding this correctly, the events in Exodus are kind of a prefiguring of that of those very things in salvific history. Moses going before God and asking God to forgive these people.
That makes a lot of sense. Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if this is outside Exodus. If it is, I apologize. But in reference to Moses, it's always bothered me, because I didn't understand it, why God did not allow Moses to come into the mm-hmm. Promised Land. Can you just go over that, especially?
That's outside of Exodus.
Okay, so forget it.
I don't know. I've gone back and forth over that, and I don't really know. The most satisfying answer to me is there's symbolism involved there that God wanted to retain. That Moses comes to stand for something, and it's important for God to retain that symbolism. And so he wouldn't allow Moses to go into the Promised Land. But.
And what is it he did that was so problematic?
Well, as I recall, the text says that he struck the rock twice. Mm. And when he was told to do it once. And I think he says, God and I have provided you water or something like that.
He said what?
God and I. Okay. I think so. Does anybody? I think that's basically what it says. So it seems to be the reason that's given that he was not allowed to go in is he apparently did something that was unauthorized. He kind of took credit for something that he shouldn't have taken credit for. That appears to be the case. But I think more significantly, he came to symbolize something and to keep the symbolism that God wanted built into history, he couldn't go into the Promised Land.
Yeah, and I don't know, the thing that kind of, I guess, comforts me is that he seems to have accepted it very,
absolutely,
you know, like that's the right, he didn't,
absolutely,
didn't quibble,
right?
So just a little question on number 7, Feast of the Tabernacles, in reference to the history of salvation. What was that in reference to?
The Feast of the Tabernacles? The Eternal Kingdom is what that represents.
So if the Feast of the Tabernacles represents being in the wilderness going towards the Promised Land, I'm not sure I get the connection with eternity.
Right. I think we are intended to keep Exodus.
Oh, okay.
So the story ends at the end of Exodus.
Okay.
And so what the event that this corresponds to, I think, has to be the tabernacle being built and God coming down and dwelling in the tabernacle. And that's the end of the story for the purposes of this.
So with reference to eternity, is it God coming
and being in
us?
God being in our midst, in our very midst, being right here with us in eternity.
Being with us here and now and individually?
I think it's talking about in heaven, essentially.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
About the definition of idolatry, is that trying to get from a foreign god something that God has promised or that God says only I can provide? Or is that creating a god, sort of God's weaker little brother, that is not as strict on the moral issues, but will still get you what you want?
I don't know. That's the talk I didn't do. I need to think a lot more about the nature of idolatry. That's a big topic. That's a very big topic. And clearly, it starts out in the Old Testament as literally bowing down before statues and worshiping them. But as it becomes clear, as you go on, even in the Old Testament, that that's not the heart of the issue. You can be idolatrous without an idol being anywhere in sight. Wow. Well, that's what I need to sort out. And in the New Testament, I mean, what is it? 1 John ends with, don't worship idols. And in the whole letter, it said nothing about idols. So it's abstracting that out. There's a principle there that I don't think that was just by the way. I think that's an integral part of the letter. And so there's a principle that's being abstracted out, and that's what I need to do a lot more thinking about. And so my answer is, I don't know.
If it's hard for you to figure out, I'm good with that.
You shouldn't be.
And on Passover, I have this constant harangue about Passover. Passover was not about sin. And Jesus, it says, is our Passover. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that the Passover, and it's odd that they would have to do anything to not be killed by God that night when God's already told them they're his chosen people. So why did they have to go out of their way to not get killed? Because God was coming down to punish the Egyptians. I think it's sort of an identification ritual. We've chosen to be with you. We're showing everybody we have chosen you. And it's an identification ritual. And there's something about when Jesus says, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to me. There's something about the crucifixion being the blood on your doorpost. If you identify with that, not only are you putting yourself at risk, but you're saying, this is where I want to be. This is who I want to follow. This is, so does that make sense?
That makes sense. That's possible.
I mean, they're the only ones that left. They're the only ones that got taken out. Yeah. Were them. And right. So there weren't any more.
Right.
Anyway.
To say that the Passover is like the crucifixion, that's the easy part. The hard part then is, in what way is it like that? And that's really, that's food for thought. And that's why it seems to me that the feasts were designed to be very thought-provoking. In what way are these the same? And that's a difficult answer, that's a difficult question. And there's quite a bit at stake at getting it right. I'm probably not going to be able to come up with a good example of this, but I've been using some Jewish commentaries that have been very good throughout the book. But there are times when they will say, this is like X. And I can see why they think that this is like X. But I'm confident that they've missed it by 2 degrees. It's a little bit different than X. It's X prime. But that 2 degrees makes a huge difference. Even in this thing that I read from the book that the Jewish way, you can see in that part of his perspective is that Sukkot is a picture of the world that we are working to create. And his whole view is that the redemption that Exodus represents is us making our way to basically the perfect society. And he goes on to say, I didn't read this, but he goes on to say that Christians have made the mistake of spiritualizing all this stuff, that it's an individual's journey, and that's how they respond to God that's important. And he says, They've missed what Sukkot is all about. What Sukkot is all about is establishing utopia here on this earth. Well, he's missed by 2 degrees, and 2 degrees count. That's significant. And I could give you other, if I had time, I'd give you other examples. But so one has to think about these correlations very carefully. They aren't easy. It's real food for thought.
I wonder if the nature of the metaphor turns on the pouring out of wrath, where in the Passover, you know, you have this fantastic picture of of the wrath that's poured out on Egypt to purchase Israel, you know, and the wrath that's poured out on the Lamb to purchase. Right.
Right. That's a good point. That's a good possibility. Yeah. Well, when you. That's what's really tricky here. I mean, you have to be careful how far you carry these analogies. And sorting that out is not an easy thing. Okay. Well, I have enjoyed going through Exodus immensely. I have learned a ton. So I thank you for indulging me. I was thinking about this stuff and thinking about when I was younger, Easter was a big deal. Easter has ceased to be a big deal. I would guess if you were to go out on Easter Day and poll the people out on the streets, that less than 40 would know that this is Easter. It has no cultural support whatsoever anymore. And as a result, it's become kind of a stale and neglected holiday. And yet, if we understand its significance, if we understand what it corresponds to in Exodus, what it corresponds into salvific history, it seems to me it becomes a much more interesting and truly important. I mean, we can see the importance of what that day represents, and I mean, we owe our eternal lives to that. It's a big deal. Okay, thanks.